I signed with EMI literally because when I walked into EMI Publishing, they had a Lyle Lovett poster behind them and they told me Guy Clark wrote there. And I said, oh, I'm signing here. I don't care who else gives me an offer.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Patrick Davis was a young singer-songwriter out of Camden, South Carolina, when he became a favorite of the members of Hootie and the Blowfish. That boost helped him launch a thriving career as a songwriter in Nashville, where he's written tracks with and for artists from Jimmy Buffett to Jewel to Morgan Wallen. Now he's the host of the TV series Southern Songwriters with Patrick Davis, produced by South Carolina ETV and airing on public TV stations nationwide. In each episode, he brings in some of his songwriter friends to play and sing. And along the way, he visits a South Carolina town to learn about its history. Patrick and I talked about the life of a Nashville songwriter and why South Carolina still draws him home. But we start by reminiscing about the life of a recently departed songwriting legend. Here's our conversation. We're going to get to your show and your career and all that stuff in just a second. But first, I thought I want to get your thoughts on something because just a few days ago, Kris Kristofferson passed away. And I was just wondering if you have any Kristofferson stories or have any thoughts about sort of what his life and career as a songwriter meant to you, if anything.
Well, Kristofferson is, you know, if you can't call yourself a songwriter, especially not someone that kind of is spent a lot of time in Nashville and not be a fan of Kris Kristofferson. I mean, I was lucky enough to write in the early days of being in Nashville. This is the early 2000s. I wrote for EMI Music Publishing, which actually had Kristofferson's catalog, I believe, because I had, you know, back in the days of CDs and, you know, where we could go into the old tape room, which back then was just like this. It was like a big library of everything that had ever been recorded by EMI artists and songwriters in Nashville. So you just had this just crazy amount of musical knowledge just right there at your fingertips. So I actually remembered stealing a couple of the early demos from Kristofferson and really diving into those. And you know, his voice was kind of like Dylan. It was like, it's kind of an acquired taste. You know, not everybody loves it, but if you get into it for purely for the musical, the beauty of his poetry that he wrote, then you don't mind the lyrics. The vocals are just wonderful. You don't care about it as much. But man, such beautiful songs, and incredible lines. Actually, my favorite Kristofferson song was actually always "Here Comes That Rainbow Again."
The scene was a small roadside cafe. Waitress was sweeping the floor. Two truck drivers drinking their coffee. Two Okie kids by the door.
I was always thought it was just such a beautiful story. And then I was reading The Grapes of Wrath, and I realized that he had taken one of the really small Steinbeck little, like, you know, the small chapters that he would do about the kids. The story talks about these kids in Oklahoma that only have a penny, and they go into a truck stop and ask the waitress for some candy, and he's, how much is it? And she goes, oh, you're lucky, that's two for a penny. And then one of the guys at the truck stop goes, that, you know, that's not true. And, you know, but it's just this beautiful, beautiful story. And I realized on a plane I was flying, and I actually started crying. I'm an emotional guy. When I read the Steinbeck thing and realized that what that had come from was Kristofferson had taken this story that was in this other form of literature and taken it and put it into this beautiful song. And then I dove into that particular song and found out that Johnny Cash had said that was the greatest song ever written, which is very, Here Comes That Rainbow Again is not a big, it's not Bobby McGee or Help Me Make It Through the Night. It's not one of those songs, but that that's kind of a really neat story for me, just about how, you just never know where inspiration comes from. And sometimes I feel like I'm an encyclopedia of a lot of music, and all of a sudden I felt like I knew nothing. Once I figured that out, I was like, oh my God.
So let's get to your show with the thing you're doing.
Okay. Sorry, long-winded.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So this show is sort of part musical, part like what I would consider like a guitar pull or whatever you call it, and then part travel show.
Yeah.
So how did those two things end up coming together?
The folks at South Carolina Educational Television, so the PBS arm in South Carolina, they had come to me a number of years ago and asked me if I would do a 1 hour little show that was kind of just around us playing that was going to air right before the Ken Burns first episode of the Ken Burns documentary that was Nashville Music City when they did that documentary. And so I did that and it went really well. And I think they won some awards, maybe regional or something from that show. And they came back and said, hey, if you would be interested, maybe you could do an actual show if you could put something together. So I said, let me think about it. And I'd always love Anthony Bourdain. And I always loved Austin City Limits and those types of shows. And in Nashville, we do In the Round shows. There's, you know, the Bluebird Cafe, of course, is the most famous place. But we do those, you know, there's probably 500 of them a night all over the city, you know. But most people don't see that outside of Nashville. So I said, how about I do a show where I kind of get to, I was a history major in college. I go, what if I get to go around and kind of finally use my degree and, you know, and talk to folks in the South. I love the South being from here. And then also a show and take these little small Southern towns and kind of prop them up. I want people to realize just how special a place like Camden, South Carolina is, not on a regional level, but I mean, on a national, on the world level, like, and that's something that you can find almost every small town everywhere, but definitely in the South, we've got history, we've got icons that maybe have been forgotten that need to be remembered.
And so Camden, that's where you grew up and your dad owns a guitar store there. Is that right?
Yeah, my dad was a school teacher when I was a kid, but he was a weekend warrior. You know, he played in all the bars and honky tonks. I mean, I say it on the TV show, but I always use the same line. He literally was the Eric Clapton of three counties. You know, he was everybody knew him. Every place from the country club to the place where there's chicken wire on the stage. You know, they knew who Rusty Davis was. So when he retired from teaching, he started a guitar store right in the middle of the heart of downtown Camden, South Carolina. And he's got every time I walk in there, it's kind of like Floyd's barbershop in Mayberry, but except for they have guitars. It's just a bunch of old guys, trying to decide if Led Zeppelin or the Rolling Stones are better or, you know, and it's just a lot of fun. And then there's kids in there that are learning. I walked in the other day and the girl was, she's 9 years old and she's learning Freebird. You know, that's what she wanted to learn.
And is he the one who taught you to play?
He did. I grew up playing sports, so I wasn't really big in music until I was probably about 15 or 16 was when I kind of picked up the instrument at the beginning. But when I picked it up, it was like an old friend because I had, not the guitar necessarily, but music in general was like, I had this wealth of knowledge from just being around my dad and all of his buddies. They all had been playing music for Camden, my little hometown. And you know, South Carolina, North Carolina, the whole region, but Camden, for example, there's two guys that are from there that my dad grew up with that are members of the Grand Ole Opry band in Nashville. There's a lot of folks that have toured and played all over. So there's like a really high bar there. And I feel like that really helped me as I, you know, kind of climbed up the ladder in different ways because I wasn't afraid of being in the room with people that were better than me or I wasn't afraid of anyone being better than what I'd already seen when I was 15 or 16 years old, listening to them do One Way Out in a honky tonk.
Yeah. When did you start getting serious about it?
I think in high school I loved playing, but it wasn't until I always give credit to the Hootie and the Blowfish guys, which are not really, the Hootie boys are incredible at what they do. My music is definitely more singer-songwriter Americana. I grew up on Southern rock and the Beatles, you know, but they were in Columbia, South Carolina when I was in college. They were, had, you know, the biggest band in the world. They're 10, 15 years older than I am, but they came to, they would come and see me play. And I remember the guys, Mark Bryan, who's the guitar player for Hootie, dear friend, like a big brother. And then Darius and those guys would go, hey man, if you want to make it in this business, you got to write your own music. Like that's the only, like that's what separate REM. Like you talk about, like, you know, there's probably a million bands that were great in Athens, Georgia in the 80s, but they did cover songs, you know, and you can still do some covers, but you gotta write your own music. And that was a really big deal for me to hear from someone that had made it, you know, someone that was successful that we all dreamed of, like, wow, they're playing Madison Square Garden.
What was that like at first? Because you've been playing other people's songs. What, I mean, did you feel like you had, I'm not sure the right way to ask this, did you have like the emotional depth you felt like to write your own stuff?
I think we all have it in us, you know, if we can dig down deep enough. No, I think the thing for me was that it helped, once again, thinking about my dad and growing up on what I consider to be some of the best music ever, you know, real, organic, like these guys were all talented. They were writing, they weren't writing for necessarily for fame or fortune. They were writing because it's what they had to do and they had to play that music. You know, that's, you know, Kristofferson wasn't writing to be, you know, help me make it through the night because he needed to be, you know, on the radio. It was because he needed to get this out into the world. I felt like I was diving back into music that I'd been listening to that was so good that it helped me because it meant that in order for me to play a song, I've written a lot of really terrible songs, don't get me wrong. I'm saying that what happens is you know where the bar is. You know, you start, you kind of recognize, you're like, well, no, that's not good. Throw that line. It doesn't mean you don't, sometimes you just put down ideas because you have to get them out of the way. Sometimes you have to get, you know, it's crowded in that room. So get all that stuff out so you can find it. You bring in a new couch. I felt like it was very scary, but at the same time, everybody has to do it. You know, there was a time that Paul McCartney had never written a song, you know, like it's, so that's kind of where I am.
Do you remember the first time you played one of your songs for somebody else?
It was probably some terrible song for some girl, you know, but the first time that I played, you know, a song that I still could play today, I was probably 19 or 20. And I remember playing a song that, I did it, my first album that I did, which was, I think 2003 or four. I did it with Mark Bryan from Hootie. He was the producer of that album for me. And he was, like I said, big cheerleader for me. And still to this day is, I played it. There's a song on that called Rock Myself, which I remember writing and being very proud of the fact that I played it for a few friends and they asked for it again. You know, they didn't go, oh, that's cute, you know, and did just move on. But I get just as terrified now sometimes playing a new song. I really have to know that I feel good about it. You know, I don't want to just play something. And also because when you get older, you know, I've had successes, you know, so you know what the reaction should be if it's going to be great. And so you can kind of tell when you play something and people are like, that's a bad feeling.
And what made you decide you needed to go to Nashville and try your hand there?
Back in the day of liner notes, you know, and CDs and albums and tapes back then, I remember just kind of looking at, I didn't grow up on country music. I grew up, you know, like I said, like, I mean, probably at that time in the late 90s, early 2000s, listening to like a bunch of Springsteen and Ray Charles and Joe Cocker. And, you know, that was kind of my, but I also listened to Lyle Lovett. I got turned on to Lyle Lovett. And I remember somebody told me that I sounded like Lyle Lovett. And I was like, that guy that was married to Julia Roberts with the crazy hair, I didn't know anything about him. And then I dove into it and I actually saw him, which is kind of full circle. I saw him on Austin City Limits on PBS one night and was like blown away. And I was like, I do kind of sound like this guy. And I really loved his songwriting because it was clever. It was smart, but it was, you know, it was palatable, but it was really, really smart and well done. And I read some stuff that he talked about Guy Clark. And I said, oh, okay, who's this Guy Clark guy? And then I go into that world. And then I go, oh, Guy Clark lives in Nashville. And then I found out that Steve Earle lived in Nashville. And I found out Rodney Crowell. I found out that these people that were songwriters that maybe weren't country artists still lived in Nashville. It was the last place where you could make a living and be successful as, you know, maybe not just an artist, you could also be a songwriter. So really it was Guy Clark, Lyle Lovett's Step Inside This House album. That's, I don't know if anybody out there would know that album, but beautiful album. And Step Inside This House is a Guy Clark song. And so I actually mentioned EMI Publishing earlier when we were talking about Kristofferson. I signed with EMI literally because when I walked into EMI Publishing, they had a Lyle Lovett poster behind him and they told me Guy Clark wrote there. And I said, oh, I'm signing here. I don't care who else gives me an offer. And so I ended up getting to write with Guy and that was a beautiful, beautiful thing. But that's why I moved to Nashville. I recognized that being in that community, it didn't mean just country music. It's changed a lot now, but there was a time that it was really the last little bastion of creative musical forces in the songwriting world.
You mentioned writing with Guy Clark, and I've always been curious how songwriters do these kind of co-writing collaboration sort of things? Is it usually more organic, where like you're a buddy of somebody and you guys get together and write? Or is it like, is somebody kind of playing matchmaker for y'all and saying you two would sound, maybe work well together? How does that usually work?
Yeah, it works both ways. Both of those are options. Usually what happens is, so I moved to Nashville, got a little success through just, you know, luck and, you know, circumstance. And then my publishing company, you sign a publishing deal, and then their job is to put you in the room with people that are either like mine. Especially when you're young, they're putting you in the room with a lot of other young, just trying to, they're really throwing stuff at the wall a lot of times. But if you, I was lucky and had a great publisher, who he's now actually the head of, I write for Warner Chappell in Nashville for a long time. He's the head of Warner Chappell now, but back then he was just this kind of lower level guy at EMI. And he knew I love Guy Clark. So he was the one that kind of brought me into the world of Guy, because he said, I think this will work. And Guy was kind. This is not always the case. Guy was almost, you know, he's probably 65, 70 at this time. Guy was willing to, I always say, kind of open the door to younger writers, because he wanted to give some of his pixie dust, but make sure it kind of, you could still tell these stories. Because if he didn't write, he wrote with myself, my buddy Jed Hughes, I think Ashley Monroe. He wrote with Stapleton. There was about 20 people that he would write with that were younger. And I think that one of the reasons, because he knew that when he passed away, he wanted that torch to be carried a little further. Not that, I mean, you know, Guy was one of those guys that was just so incredible. Like the things that he would say, you'd just be like, I'm like, where the hell did that come from? You know, but just beautiful. Like, it's like writing with Hemingway. But a lot of times in Nashville, it doesn't always, as I've gotten older now, I usually only write with my friends, because you have your village. You know, I do write with younger people here and there, but I know who I write great with, and I kind of want to write with my buddies, you know. But there are a lot of times in the early days, especially of any young kid out there, there's a young kid listening, what'll happen is if you do sign a publishing deal, they're just going to throw you with everyone they can and hope that something happens. And sometimes you catch magic, and sometimes, you know, you're just kind of floundering. So
I want to go back to something you sort of passed over real quick. You said, with luck and circumstance, I had some early success.
Yeah.
So what was the luck and what was the circumstance?
Well, I think the circumstance is just, you know, it's showing up, you know, being in Nashville. You know, I was always, I'm always to this day willing to say yes to as many opportunities as I can, because I feel like, you know, it just opens a lot more doors. You know, I always say FaceTime pays overtime, and that's kind of, you know, just you got to be in the room. So I was always out and about in the early days of being in Nashville. I moved to Nashville though. Now that's kind of blasé. Everybody can move everywhere. Back in the early 2000s, like there was like two people I knew from the state of South Carolina that lived in Nashville, Tennessee, and they weren't my age. They were older. You know, it was a very different situation than now. You know, kind of every kid lives in Nashville, Tennessee. And so I had to make that move. That was the circumstance, getting myself in that area, in the rooms. And then luck is just, my uncle worked for I think back then it was either Clear Channel or one of the radio stations, and had a friend that was bringing some shows through. I ended up opening up shows for a guy named Pat Green. It was a Texas guy. His drummer, who was his producer, liked my little album that I had, asked if I'd write some songs with him. I write some songs. They end up getting on his album, which he ends up signing a major deal in Nashville. All of a sudden, I've got a song that's going to be on the radio and country radio that, you know, I don't even listen to country radio, you know, like, I mean, so so many things had to kind of fall into place, you know.
And that was Dixie Lullaby, right?
Yeah, that was Dixie Lullaby.
And they danced to a Dixie Lullaby, a picture of love beneath the southern sky. Oh my, what a beautiful life, just like a
And so that was the first song of yours that kind of people heard about.
Yeah, that opened the door. I'd had a few other things that had happened that were on a smaller scale. Like there was a guy named Corey Morrow that was a Texas artist that I met that had this giant song that I wrote with Corey on Texas radio, which doesn't sound like much, but it's a big thing in Texas, like down there for the independent artists. And, you know, it was like, I think it was like 20 weeks number one. It was something ridiculous, you know. And that, you know, you make $500 from that happening, you know, down there. But that kind of started opening some doors. And then it just is a matter of, it's like I said, it's just You got to take advantage of that luck where you can. But the circumstances, the being in the right place at the right time is a really big component. And it's almost like you asked about writing, co-writing, you know, and there's so many stories. There's so many of us that can say, oh my God, the only reason that song even got written was because I decided to say yes to somebody asking me to join him and another person to write that day. I didn't even want to. I was hungover. I didn't want to be there, but I walked into the room and some magic was hanging there for us to pull down. And that's kind of, and there's so many stories like that. I've probably have 50 songs myself that are like that, but I've heard over and over so many stories of someone being like, I didn't want to be there that day, but I showed up and then this happened.
When we come back, Patrick Davis talks about what songwriters don't like to talk about.
We're afraid to talk too much about the process because we don't actually understand it.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Patrick Davis. I always love asking musicians this. Do you remember the first time you heard one of your songs sort of out in the world?
Yeah. I think the first time I actually heard a song that I had anything to do with it, it was actually my voice singing it, which was different because for about 10 or 15 years, I really just wrote for people. But it was on WNCW. And is that in Nashville?
Yeah, sure.
I was driving to Nashville and they had played, someone there had gotten my little, you know, first little album called Chances Are and was playing. I don't even remember what song it was. It might've been Rock Myself. I can't remember what song it was, but I remember being like, holy shit. And you know, and then of course you think that the next thing you're gonna be on, you know, you're gonna be on I don't know, all the late night shows or something and playing Madison Square Garden. That's not always how it works. That was kind of a really beautiful thing. And then it's really great to hear anytime any song, like, you know, I've been watching a TV show before and a song that I've written for someone else, I'll go, holy shit, that's our song. Like it's in the back of some TV show. You know, you don't even get told sometimes. You don't know because it gets lost in the translation. I mean, you know that you're going to get paid from it from your publisher, but they maybe forgot to send you an email and say, hey, in episode 5 of blah blah blah, you're going to be in the ending credits. You know, so it's always a thrill though. I don't think that ever goes away. I don't get to write quite as much as when we were kids, you know, writing in Nashville. If your only job is writing songs in Nashville, you'll write 200, 300, 400 songs in a year. You churn them out. It's a law of percentages. But these days I kind of am a little more, I hone in a little bit more and only write when it really, you know, it hits me in the right spot. I don't really chase that dragon quite as much anymore, you know.
The format of the show with the, you know, you have 3 or 4 singer-songwriters, you know, trading songs and all, which is a, you know, familiar format. I'm sure you've played in that many, many times. How competitive is it?
These are just all my buddies. You know, like I literally, you know, I've always said the same thing, but doing this for 20, 25 years, I have a pretty big Rolodex, little black book of my friends that I can call on. And you know, the great thing about season 1, you know, we've already started working on season 2. We haven't shot any of the shows yet, but we're already getting there. But season 1, it's so hard to find. You know, there's 4 of us on stage. So it's myself and 3 other people. And we're trying to get all of our schedules together so that they can even show up. So it was, you know, the people that really love me and had the ability to be there were there for season 1, you know. And season 2, I think it's even going to be better because now they're going to know it was actually on television. They're going to see it and they're going to be like, oh, now I really want to do it, you know. But the thing is, these are all my friends. And so I don't think there's a lot of competition. I really think I hope that you can see it on our faces. There's a real joy when we watch each other play. It's really a wonderful thing to know that someone in our little, you know, our little neighborhood is that talented. Mark Broussard sitting beside me. Mark Broussard is one of the best voices in the world. Like, it's not like there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And the thing is that what Mark does, I could never do, but also what I do, Mark can't do. And it's like, you just have to kind of look at that. Dan Tominski's sitting there. Well, Dan's got, you know, more Grammys than he's got fingers and toes, you know, like he's got something magical. And we, and Christian Bush from sure. I mean, we're cheering each other on. And I think that's the best of what you hope for all of us. And of course we're competitive. Everybody wants, you know, you'll look online and be like, why are they playing that show? Why am I not on that show? That's human nature. You know, someone gets a number one song or something and you're like, damn it. I should have wrote with them that day. You know, but at the same time with the TV show, I think one of the great things about it, and I hope that people feel this. I've heard this from the folks that have attended the shows, and I've heard it from people that have seen the episodes. They're like, man, y'all look like you're having so much fun. And I say, that's kind of what I want to make sure comes off, is because playing music for a living and having people there and you know, clapping and cheering you on is such a beautiful privilege. When I see it, I think we're just how lucky we are. So I'm never upset about anybody, any of my friends having success. I think it's magic. And I hope that when people watch the TV show, they recognize this is unscripted. None of this was planned out. We've never practiced the songs. We don't know what we're playing. We don't tell each other what we're playing. We can kind of guess because I know Mark's going to play Home. I know Christian Bush is going to play, you know, Baby Girl. I know Dan Tominski is going to play Man of Constant Sorrow, but we don't have any, there's nothing. It's supposed to happen spontaneous. And I feel like a lot of times with TV shows, music shows, especially, it's so scripted. It's, you know, exactly what's going on. You have a three minute and 15 second cutoff. And if you don't hit it within that time, you know, it doesn't mean it's not great. It just means this is a little different. I hope that's what people take from it, is they feel that there's a camaraderie and a cheerleading of happening on stage for each other.
I feel like when people from the outside ask about songwriters, we're like always curious about sort of the little logistical details of the process, like what kind of notebook do you use and what time of morning do you write and all that sort of thing. When songwriters get together, what is that shop talk like? Is it completely different? I mean, you're talking about completely different things than what somebody from the outside would talk about?
In which capacity do you mean, while we're...
Well, I mean, like...
Hanging out.
Yeah, if you're like hanging out, or even, I guess, maybe if you're getting ready to do some work together, do you talk about, like, you know, what kind of guitar strings do you use and that sort of thing? Or is that just, that stuff already too boring for you guys when you're talking to each other?
No. We just love music, just like the, you know, that's the, we just happen to be, you know, we make it, you know, some of us better than others, you know, like it's just, that's all it is. We, you know, when we sit down, we might talk about, like, I love old guitars. So I might talk about, you know, and one of my other buddies might love old guitars, and we just talk about, oh man, did you see this? I bought this. I got this. You know, we don't really necessarily talk shop. A lot of times when it comes to writing, you kind of want to start just with normal conversation. And then see if anything, because you don't always walk into the room with gold, you know. You sometimes walk into the room with just nothing. I go, you got anything? No. You got anything? No. And so you just sit there and just, you know, you shoot the shit for an hour or two, or for 20 minutes, whatever it is, to get that. And then so what usually happens is we say, oh man, I saw this article, you know, on the internet today, or I did you see this thing that happened? Did you hear about this? And then that creates, oh man, that made me think about this. And then you never know. Then something, it could be a, you know, somebody could just be playing the guitar and a guitar groove happens, and that creates something. It's pretty organic. It's not, I don't think we necessarily sit around and talk shop. I mean, we're afraid to talk too much about the process because we don't actually understand it, you know, but you just kind of want to keep your antenna always up. You know, I have in my phone, probably my album, I have an album coming out here soon. And there's probably four or five of those songs that were created literally just from in my notes section of my phone, having a title. Like I thought while I was driving, you know, there's a Willie Nelson thing. He said, if I need to write a song, I just go for a drive. You know, that's because it always kind of, because you can zone out and think. But there'll be a lot of that with me. I'll have lines that I thought of while I was driving, and I'll just put them in my phone. And that ends up being the thing that when we're sitting down and writing, we go, hey, you got any ideas? I go, let me look at my phone. And we'll look through and see what notes we put down. That's kind of, I think, probably the more natural thing that actually happens.
And does it tend to, when you do it, does the words tend to come first or the music, or does it, is it both sometimes?
Every now and then you'll get a melody that, you know, you just kind of, once again, another famous story is Paul McCartney and Yesterday with Scrambled Eggs. You know, he just broke around right. the house, so we didn't forget the melody. Sometimes you will find a melody and you really love that melody. And some of my friends that are really incredible writers, especially the guys that write more, maybe a little more in the pop world, they're real melody based. And so they are always thinking about melody. You know, I'm more prone to probably, you know, I'll probably listen to like I said, Bob Dylan or the songwriter world, you know, more. So the melody, while important, is not necessarily the I want to hear the lyrical content. You know, for me, it's usually lyric based. It's usually a title or a line that kind of gets me going. And sometimes I'll write like we'll walk into a room and maybe I'll have the first verse and a chorus, but I just need some tweaking. Like one of the guys is on the series, Jed Hughes, he'll be on episode 2 of the series. He's an incredible guitar player, one of the best guitar players in the world, plays in Vince Gill's band, plays with everybody. We wrote a song together that I remember I had the first couple of verses kind of written in the chorus, but there was just, it needed something. And he brought one word in that changed the entire thing, you know, and that's kind of the magic of writing with other people. I can spend weeks trying to get one line of one song, you know, because I just get stuck, like we all do. We get stuck in life. That's just, you know, just kind of just rolling in the, or stuck in the mud. And so sometimes I think that's the benefit of writing with other people. I'm always amazed. I do write songs by myself, but they take forever. But I'm always amazed at people that can solely write. Like, you know, when they tell you that they wrote this album and it's 12 songs and they wrote it in 6 months, and then the next one comes out 6 months later and they write them all, but like Springsteen or something, you're like, how is this possible? Like you can't, like you just have to be just so, you know, you have to grind to do that, you know.
You talked about loving old guitars. Do you have a guitar that you think of as like the hit maker, you know, like when you really need something, this is the one you pick up?
I'm not a good enough guitar player to have a hit maker. no, I love different guitars for different reasons. I have on the floor right here is a 1940 Kalamazoo, a beautiful little guitar, that's real easy to play and fun to play. So like, I don't have to fight it. You know, you want an instrument that you can just kind of, you know, and, but then there's other times I want to play in an open tuning, you know, this guitar nerd world. But like, if you know, if you want to play in open G or open C or D or whatever, like there's certain guitars that I have around the house that are those guitars. No, I do like to think that every guitar that I own in the right circumstance will have some magic in it for to come. I feel like, you know, that's kind of a cliche, but it's like, there's going to be some good songs in this one. And that's true to me, because when you find a guitar that becomes a piece of you, you know, you love it so much, you know, sometimes it just has a certain thing. I think that's I think any guitar player will tell you that.
So this is a series of Southern songwriters. Is there something about the South that makes it particularly good fodder for songs and songwriting? Like, is there a reason there's a Southern songwriter series and maybe not a Midwestern songwriter series or something like that?
I think the South is, you know, I touched on it with my hometown of Camden, South Carolina. Camden is, you know, it's not old for Europe or for the rest of the world, but it was founded in, you know, 1732. So that's very old for the United States. And I think that we have a lot of old history, you know, good and bad, in these waters and mountains and towns and the people. And so I feel like for writing purposes, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why there's so many authors that are from, you know, the South. I think there's so many people that aren't from the South that write about the South. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, heck, you know, John Fogerty was from San Francisco area, and he wrote pretty much exclusively about Louisiana, you know, or Mississippi. I think there's a lot of voodoo in those hills, you know, type of situation that just kind of, that is very romantic though. I think that's one thing my buddy Christian Bush talks about that with the South. He's like, you know, it's like people just have this idea of the South where the weather's a little better, the food's a little sweeter, the women are a little prettier, you know, it's just like, that people love that. But I also think that it's forgotten. I think that a lot of the rest of the world takes it for granted almost. And so that's what I kind of want to shine that spotlight. That's kind of why I think you say like kind of the travel show portion of Southern Songwriters. You know, it's only about 10 minutes of the show, 6 to 10 minutes are that. The rest of it is music. The music brings you to the party. The educational portion of the show is very small, but my goal with it was to, you know, there's a million times that you've just seen a concert. TV, you know, that happens all the time. And it's a lot more, I'm going to tell you, it is so much more work to do those little vignettes and those stories than it is to go on that stage and play. Going on the stage and playing is easy. We do that all the time. The actual going out and shooting it and finding all that footage and getting that, you know, talking to people, finding out who to talk to. But that's part of, I think, the charm of it. I do genuinely love the South, and I want to celebrate that, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's a lot of that, but I think there's so much beautiful history there that is kind of forgotten, even amongst those of us that are from the South. Like I found things out about my hometown that I didn't have any. I was a history major. I would think that I would know these things, and I'm like, wait, what happened here? You know, there's things like that that just happen, and every town has those. And the important thing with Southern Songwriters is not to make it where we're telling stories that are only important to the folks in South Carolina or North Carolina. I want, you know, this is going to air in New York City. This is airing in San Francisco. I want those people, when they have an episode that is, you know, taking place in Sumter, South Carolina, to find it extraordinary that we have a world-renowned, or Sumter has a world-renowned sculptor from there. I want them to find, you know, I want to make these stories something that people go, wow, I can't believe that exists there.
A great song can feel like magic, but songwriting itself is a craft, like sewing a quilt or building a chair. Patrick Davis goes to work every day writing songs for others and himself so he can make a living. As we talked about in our conversation, a big part of his job is just showing up, saying yes when another songwriter asks to collaborate, even if he has nothing in his notebook. It's that constant practice that provides the time and the space for great things to happen. To paraphrase the writer Elizabeth Gilbert, the muse will arrive, but she better find your butt in the chair. If you watch Southern Songwriters, you'll probably see some artists you've never heard of. Maybe you never heard of Patrick Davis before this episode. But what you'll hear from him and others is the product of lifetimes of showing up, learning the craft, doing the work, and being open to the magic. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.